Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Bar down there, everyone that Steve-O, who's managing Soft Cell, and everybody used to go there for talking deals, and all the punks were there having a late drink. It was amazing. So I was taken in when I was 18 first, and then the people who were just starting the hotel then, they were also in their teens, kind of young. And we've kind of all grown old together in one hotel, so it is a bit like 40 towers there, you know?
I guess it was the kind of place where almost anything went as well, right?
Oh, fuck, can you imagine? But, you know, it's got a very... I mean, one of the ladies who served in breakfast, she only left about 3 years ago, but she was here during the war.
Wow.
And this was full of American officers, this hotel. And she said we used to get stockings and chocolate off them and all this kind of thing. She'd been here that long. Can you imagine it?
And this has been your room ever since you've stayed here as well.
Yes, that's true.
Is it changed?
There was a change minimal. Bed here, and that's gone. No, it hasn't changed, you know. I mean, this faces south. It's all kind of Masonic. It's a very interesting room.
And that's a proper marble fireplace,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's right. So, yeah, a long time in this room, absolutely, and in this hotel.
A lot of history.
Yeah, the band used to fucking bitch about me insisting we stay here, but now they insist on it.
It's kind of come full circle.
Well, because they're all smokers, Big Paul, right?
Yeah.
You can't smoke anywhere. It's the last one left.
Okay, fine, Columbia it is. Yeah. I've just heard as well, I wasn't eavesdropping, obviously, but I've just heard you mention outside on the corridor there that you recently moved to Peru.
Yeah.
How exciting.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, and I've spent a lot of time in Peru since I was 22. I've been going there. And the country has changed so much since 1982. It's incredible. And I love the Quechua people. And I'm opening up a club there and, you know, this kind of thing. I'm working with, I'm doing masterclasses there with classical music and with rock music as well, with anything I see that's particularly experimental and angry and with a fuck off attitude, and then I put them through their paces with me. And so what I've been doing is I've been working with this South American record company called Boo Records, and I just pick any band I like around South America. Then I do these masterclasses with them, and then we put the sessions out on Boo Records. And now what I'm going to do is I'm starting a club, and I'm going to take the club literally around South America with the bands. But it's going to have lots of things in it. I mean, this is a club where everybody has to be masked. It's a masquerade, right? And there's going to be lots of extraneous entertainment. And it's a club, see? So it'll be members first policy, you know, and affordable for like the average Joe. Affordable, but you have to get in there. You know, So that's what that's the kind of thing I'm doing for fun in South America while I'm doing my studies with you know, the archaeology of the region, which has always been there for me. So there's always multiple reasons why I go to any one place. You know.
Did you grow up in an academic household, Jazz? Like, where does that side come from?
My parents are teachers, but they're from two very extraordinary families. I mean, the Coleman family, you know, my great-grandfather was a millionaire at the beginning of the last century. And then on the Indian side, from mum's side, that's Congress Party in India, pretty much, my my family, you know, the pandits. And so it's an interesting sort of DNA experiment, you know, because my grandfather worked for Indian military intelligence and did really dodgy stuff, you know, like in the 1962 war with China, he executed some of his own men for cowardice and stuff like this. He had like a terrible temper, which I realise I've inherited. Yes, you should shoot traitors. I demand absolute loyalty.
I love it. And your sense of humour for me is a big part of your character. And where does that come from? Is that inherited from upbringing?
Obviously, all of us, Monty Python, we were brought up with this, of course. Well, the English sense of humour, the outlook is unique, isn't it? It's one thing.
Definitely.
I'm deeply patriotic about it, one thing.
Yeah.
And the team, two things. There you go. But yeah, I love British humour and to be in Killing Joke, they're the only group of people that I've actually had to start a physical fight with because I'm laughing so much in pain.
Brilliant.
I've never had this from any of the people, you know, and they're so witty, and Raven, of course, was the same as, but all of them, Youth is a hysterical person. I mean, and then being on tour with Killing Joke, oh my God, I'm afraid no one can peep inside. It's too terrible. No one can have a look inside. It's so funny. They are the funniest people I've known, and they're such great individuals intellectually. I mean, everybody in the band, you know.
I go on quite a lot of tours, and I can see the difference between a band who enjoy each other's company and have, as you say, intellectual discussions and debates and can roll around the floor laughing.
There's not many of them.
And then you see the ones who just kind of don't like each other and don't like touring, and that shows on stage as well, doesn't it? That translates into the show. You can kind of tell when a unit is tight and on the same page and doing it for the right reasons.
Well, that's right. You know, yeah. I mean, Big Paul said something the last time we were out, and he said, all my family have passed away. You boys, the band's the only family I've got. And we are. Even when we fall out with each other, we are very, very close as individuals. That's true.
Well, you've been through a hell of a lot, haven't you? You know, obviously, individually and collectively. What was the catalyst for the original lineup sitting down and getting back together?
Well,
a few years back?
Mean, Paul passing for sure.
That would have been it.
That was it. But in saying that, I always knew it was going to happen. In the 20 years that Paul went away, there was not one moment I had any doubt that he'd come back. You know.
Is that because you'd had conversations to that effect, or is it just that you felt that there's a kinship there?
I know him.
Transcends circumstance.
I know him. Yeah. You know. The most important thing is to try and, while we're here, is to try and work our differences out. Killing Joke's been an incredible learning process. I mean, it's been my total university. I mean, you know that I left school with no exams, with four criminal offences, actually.
At 15, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I was completely wild, you know. I mean, the last time I went to court, I thought I was going to go to Borstal. I was ready for it. They warned me that I probably would, but I was very lucky. It was the classical music that saved me.
Yeah, when did that come into the fold as a, you know, a real area of passion and interest?
Probably about the age of six.
Right. So it was there from
as far back as you can remember, music.
Really.
Well, it was ritualistic music because I learned most things in the church choir, then at the Royal School of Church Music, and then I was selected to go on different cathedral courses and stuff like this. And so it was a good way of like missing out on school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that, and at the same time I developed the violin. So I miss out on school by going on to chamber music courses with the violin, you see. So I did these two things. So I managed to avoid a lot of school. My parents being teachers, I mean, you know, my mother is the original Asian tiger mother, which is, you know, what are you interested in? Good, now you're going to do it, that kind of thing, you know. So that meant like rearing moths, and we traveled a lot. I didn't stay in a hotel until I was in Killinjoke, and I didn't go on a plane until I was in Killinjoke. I was camping before that.
I love the new record, and I've just been on tour myself for a few weeks, and I got home last night, and you know obviously what it's like when you come home off the road. You're a little bit physically drained, you're a little bit emotionally drained,
yes,
but you're riding on this high,
yes,
and so you're kind of in this weird state. And I put the record on, and instantly I was just kind of swept away in all these emotions. And for me, classical music was never a part of my life until I saw the work of Stanley Kubrick.
Right.
And he was the person, I think, that introduced me to that music in a contemporary context.
Right.
Before watching his films like 2001 and Clockwork Orange.
I
just kind of associated with classical music with old people in the establishment. And then you kind of see that it can be actually this very provocative and, you know, futuristic art form.
It sure is, yes.
And I wonder if you could talk me through some of the choices.
Well, just quickly go back to my childhood. So choral music in the English tradition, like Thomas Tallis and so this was a huge influence on me. This and Russian music. My first record was Russian Orchestral Masterpieces, and it had all of them there. And when I heard this, this was it for me. Look where I am now. I love working in Russia. I love Russian orchestras. They have the greatest classical tradition, I think, in the world.
And they're the orchestra people that you've worked with on this record as well, right?
Yes,
it's the St. Petersburg
Phil. And the one that's going to come out next year as well. But that's right, yeah.
Philharmonic.
Yeah, that's right. They're amazing. They're absolutely amazing. Amazing orchestra. And what was amazing about the recording, you're not going to believe this, but the biggest band in Russia is a band called Leningrad. And two of my Russian friends in Prague said, come on, we have to go and see this band. And then I said, why? They said, come on, to Russia's biggest band. And I said, why? And these two girls said, because the main guy in the band runs your fan club in Russia.
Oh, wow.
I couldn't believe it. And so it transpired that I had like a palatial place in St. Petersburg with everything, with a, you know, extractor fan for the cigars and a bar there. And I was waited on hand, but I had an amazing experience, to put it mildly.
Yeah, no.
Which I always do when I go to Russia. They always really look after me.
I've never been. I'd love to go.
You see,
it's one of the most unique countries in the world, isn't it?
What people don't know is that when I started studying classical music, the only people who basically, it started with Klaus Tennstedt. I got my first scores to him, and he was East German. This is in the 80s, and of course I didn't know how to orchestrate at this stage. So he was very kind with me, all things considered.
Patient.
Yeah. And so he put me in touch. He lived in East Germany. He put me in touch then with various people in the East. So the first people who helped me out was actually the Minsk Philharmonic. And then I also studied in Leipzig during communist times. I studied orchestration there for a very short time. And then eventually, Tennstedt got me with a Hungarian who's been my master up until this day. He's like pretty old now. And he actually went to university with Ligeti in Hungary. Yeah. So I've been very lucky. You see, what I've done in my life is I've basically made a short list of people who are living in all different mediums, I have to say. From
yeah, not even just music.
But
yeah.
I've made a short list of people who are living that I really admired their work in whatever medium. And so I banged hard on the door. If you know, I used to get phone numbers and I'm, you know, an outgoing sort of person. And so I would find them. And for the best part of the time, I had a fantastic time. They put me on the right track and they helped me. Amazing people, I mean, for different things. Like one of the things that I do is I'm a remote viewer. And I've been doing this for a long, long time. And one of the people who really helped me develop this is Yuri Geller. Yeah. And so, and like, it was interesting to hang around with Yuri because just by being there when he's doing things, you get to understand the how. And so I've been very lucky there, but I've also banged hard on the door with my own self-education process, which is really what Killing Joke is all about. Killing Joke has been in university for, well, all of us in the band. I mean, I don't think anybody's got any exams. We stuck into Killing Joke pretty soon, you know. I mean, I was 18 when I started, you know, Killing Joke. And so, the learning curve, well, it's, yeah, we used to swap books, and everybody's into the mystery tradition in Killing Joke, as I'm sure you're well aware. And so there was always a library and essential reading matter that everybody wanted everybody else's opinion on. There was some, this is interesting, yeah, you know, this is what's different about our band. They're so opinionated about so many different subjects, and so well informed that it's not easy, but it's stimulating. And the fuel that we run on is conflict. You know, disagreement, not agreement necessarily.
Is that the same when you're on the road as when you're in the studio? Is that the constant of the band?
With four strong personalities. But what we've learned, you know, how we all tick.
So you can negotiate those C's for the greater good.
And the other thing is, communism works. That's what I've learned about Killing Joke. That when you split everything equally, everybody's equally motivated.
I had a conversation with a band about this 2 or 3 days ago on tour, because they're one of the only groups from within their little scene that is all original members. And I was asking the question, how come all these other bands have changed?
There you are.
And they said, well, it's because we split the pay evenly. And
yes,
that removes a lot of
arguments.
Well, of
course, like, you can go through some real dark times and to see who's left after this. Often it's only the strong kind of can sit through the shake-ups. But then again, in Killing Joke, it's been really wild, some of the things that happened. I couldn't repeat them. And some of the things that we've had to sort of get through with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. You mentioned earlier on that you were proactive in your knocking down of doors to try and, you know, introduce yourself to people who you admire and respect. Have you had any unsurprising people from outside of the world of music come knocking on Killing Joke's tour and hi, can we come in?
Let's get to know each other,
let's exchange ideas.
Oh my God, I can't really tell say names because I don't like the name dropping thing, but royalty, NATO members, people who work high up in NATO, I mean, some really surprising characters in all sorts of life. You know? Yeah, I mean, really, really surprising. I mean, from 82, Kate Bush was always very supportive of us, and you have some real strange ones, yeah, really real strange ones out there. But it's a beautiful thing.
It is, isn't it?
That's why I refer to Killing Joke as the sublime music of Killing Joke, because it is. You know, when you, as a musicologist, I can look at the chord formations that make up Killing Joke, and it's quite unique. As a band, I find this still, after all these years, interesting, the chemistry that's there. You see, what we don't really write music per se. It doesn't work like that with us. Yeah. First of all, we have to kind of live and do all the things that we want to do for ourselves. And then when we get together, bang, we stay on one kind of rhythm, we get on a groove, and then something happens. It's like the first time we ever played together. When it happened, it was like something happens. At some point, something happens with us, the chemistry, and it locks in. It's a monster. You know, that's the... See, human beings are precious, and then magical chemistries are even more precious, so you have to know it when you've got it. And we do, and we're appreciative of each other, although it's difficult, you know? I mean, it's difficult to keep the whole thing going, I can tell you. But, you know, the ship has steered and now been navigated through choppy waters and storms and everything. Deaths and wow, you know, and here we are. And many people refer to Killing Joke as being now one of the most influential bands, well, ever actually, because somebody put it out there that our music spans two centuries. Well, it does in a kind of funny way when you think about it. And you know, for me to orchestrate this. It's very hard for me to talk about it because it involves my last manager, who I have murderous impulses towards. Right? You know, this piece, I got into so much shit for this piece because there was no preliminary budget done. You know, could it be done on pledge? No, you know, what? There was no... No one doing the checks and balances. No, it was just kind of, he'll do this and he'll do that, and without me even fucking being informed of anything. And so I was set up to fail, actually. I actually believe that I was set up to fail because it couldn't be done. They knew it. Hmm? Yeah, that's what I believe. So, what actually happened was really remarkable. I mean, people weren't telling me the truth. I don't even want to get into it because it's something. So I was really set up with the whole pledge thing, and then I was told by my management it's not going to happen and everything like this. I thought, well, you're taking the money, and the whole thing was, well, what little money came, it wasn't enough to do the job with, and so basically. What happened was, suddenly I got another commission, unconnected with Killing Joke, that I really wanted to do. And the two became one.
And probably not for the first time, right? Has that happened to you before in your life?
Sure, we have along to the road? Kind of make a project multitask in a funny way to make it work these days. You know? Yeah. But wow. I mean, anyway, what I wanted to say was, when I was in a real dark place with this project, and I, as I said, I've been set up to fail with it, and now, you know, I had to find the money to, I don't know what would happen with this project. Then I had the first dream for 25 years. For 25 years, I've had no dreams. And I dreamt of this winter palace. And everything was floodlit. It was the most beautiful winter palace I'd ever been to, seen. And it was such a vivid dream. And there was a full orchestra there, and everybody was dressed like an evening dress. And the top of the winter palace was the night sky. But it was so brilliantly lit. And I heard it, and it sounded divine. And then it happened. And I went to that winter palace, and that's 30 kilometers outside of St. Petersburg, is the Tsar's palace. I went there afterwards as well, and everything just came together. Straight after that dream, and my manageress, Carla, said to me, "You're going. We're doing it. It's happening." And I truly felt magic at work. And then with all the support from the Lucy's Trust, the whole and from actually from the Russian Ministry of Culture as well. To be honest, I mean, I was when I recorded it, I was the only Englishman left standing in St. Petersburg after all the diplomats were expelled, basically. And I can tell you, I don't know what comes up when you give your passport in, but they all start laughing when they see mine. I don't know what's there, you know. But there you go. Yes. Well, it's an interesting time we're living in now, you know.
Do you feel optimistic
about
the future of Earth and the human race?
I step back from my emotions to understand the bigger picture these days, and to try and understand it, what is going on the planet, and that is very interesting, the wider picture of geopolitics, and then some of the larger reasons why geopolitics are the way they are that are not being talked about. Looking at these, this is the thing I love about Killing Joke, is the debate, and which of course doesn't happen a lot these days. When you look at what's happening is we move from a post-democratic age into synarchy. Well, let's talk about what being in a post-democratic world means. I mean, you know, what's really behind all this is, you see, is that we're living in the sixth extinction period. And now I agree with the most of the scientists, their conclusions about global warming. But I would say that even if we did everything, I think it's part of a larger cycle, what's happening. I mean, one of the things people never talk about is the increase in volcanic activity and the why. I mean, you only have to do the maths yourself. Go back to 1900 and compare volcanic activity from the year 1900 to 1920, and then have a look to the year 2000 and 2020 and compare the two. You'll see what I mean. And then, you know, as to the why, I've got a very good idea why, because one of the things that I'm interested in is studying the Earth's magnetosphere, because you see, all the holy sites that I've been interested in from distant times, they're situated on the magnetic grid, basically. And the thing is that magnetic field, the magnetosphere, is acting very strange at the moment. For example, it should be moving like 2 centimeters a year, but it's moving at like 40, 50 kilometers a day towards Siberia, magnetic north. And the implications of this is very serious, because you see, they started setting GPS, like, so it was altered every 5, 10 years, then 5 years. And now they have to alter, readjust all the GPS systems, because GPS is aligned to the Earth's magnetic field, right? Magnetic north, which is moving very erratically. And so when you consider that, like, cars, airplanes, and everything else in between, satellite, everything is connected to the magnetosphere, and when that goes crazy, well, what happens to all that traffic? That's just one. That's the beginning. So now they're altering the GPS every year. So then what? Down to every 6 months, and then what's going to happen? Well, there you go. You see, there's one larger picture. The other thing is, of course, when we decrease a magnetic field, human beings go mad and get very aggressive.
Mm-hmm. Erratic, unpredictable.
Yeah, and so this, along with like 11-year sun cycles, which also make all living things very aggressive and act erratically. So think about it. Migrating birds, dolphins, how do they know where to fly? Well, of course, they're using the Earth's magnetic field because, you know, mammals and bird life have got magnetic, actually magnetic salts in our brain that help us align with the Earth's magnetic field. Well, you know, that's why we've seen lots of beach whales and they don't know where to go, and it's going to get worse, you see, until it gets better. And well, then that's something that we can only speculate. We can get bits and pieces from different astrophysicists, but of course it's all classified,
yeah,
like everything. So you have to use your intuition as a layman with what's actually happening there. But I, you know, it's something that I studied. I can see this is very serious, and this is I think that when this reaches its zenith, that existing nation states and forces will use it as an opportunity to make a land grab or resource grab, is my prediction.
Can we as individuals have the power and the ability to change the course of the larger future of the world, you believe? Yeah,
absolutely. Let's go down to these two basic facts that we know. We know that the physicists say that we are all participants in creating our own reality, okay? The magicians, they say magic is the science of creating change in accordance with the will. Of course, it's the same thing. Now, look, the problem I have with the patristic religions, which is the Abrahamic religions of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, is that they are essentially apocalyptic cults. Mm-hmm. And they visualize messiahs, but essentially apocalypse. And if you have a look at this Yahweh figure, as I've studied, basically, it demands blood sacrifice. This, I mean, if Yahweh, or the God of the Israelites, was tried by the International Criminal Court, he'd be tried for genocide. You know, when we look at it, with the whole scale, you know, when the Lord said, kill every man, woman, and child, and this kind of thing, I mean, you know, and you can laugh about these things. It's a little like when the elites use terminologies in talking about the population as excess population or useless eaters, and sort of phrases like this. It's basically one step away from genocide. The mindset. It means humans have no value. They're worthless. Right, therefore, you know, you've got, you know, I was just reading the paper on the BA flight over, and that, you know, the mandatory vaccinations, but at the same time you've got Bill Gates saying to a private audience, if we do a really good job on vaccines, quote unquote, we can reduce the population by 10 to 15%. And then, of course, his doctor came out and said he wouldn't let his children be vaccinated.
Yeah, and wouldn't let them have iPhones and things like this, which everyone else needs to have and should have the latest, you know, model all the time.
So I don't really have a lot of time for the existing elite. I think that irresponsible is not the word. You know.
With the artists and the thinkers and the, you know, the creatives that you've enjoyed the company of over the years, do you view, even though perhaps they might be from, say, a privileged background, do you view them as separate to what you refer to there as the elite? Do you think there's an inherent difference in somebody who's perhaps just educated and wealthy and someone who's actually out to
see it all the time? God, I mean, have a look at the, you know, British government, Cameron and so forth, of that, this government. I mean, have a look at the top businesses in this country, and you'll see the British really identified with the Indian caste system. You know, let's be honest about it. You know, that's what it is, a caste system here.
Is that where you moved?
Yes.
Yeah. And you're much happier not
there. Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm too far gone. I've been so long out of this country. I love coming back. This is the space. Interesting thing is, it's exotic for me coming back here, and wonderful. You know, I go back to my family house, the house I was born in, and the house that Brian Jones smashed up, and the house that Killing Joke lived in, and various people along the way. So it's a very special house, you know. I love this country, and but I see things. I guess I have an Indian DNA in me. I see things, the things that happen to this country, sadly, I see them as karmic.
Yeah.
Frankly, yes, I do. Let's have a look at the flashpoints in the world. Well, we can start with Ireland. You know, when you just divide and conquer and you move a load of Protestants over to a Catholic area, and then when you move Tamils, for example, into Sri Lanka, well, it was Ceylon then, and then when you move, you know, Muslim Indians into like Pakistan, you're creating division all the time, you see?
Yeah.
All the
yeah.
time, everywhere, systematically, is a policy. You know, it's very difficult because I love the British people, but that's one thing. And then there's British foreign policy and the institutions of this country, which I'm not in love with.
And we're such a divided nation now.
Look,
aren't we?
This country's had, it's not like France. There's no real tradition of effective change.
Yeah, there's no beheadings of kings or anything like that.
or
for a long time, at least.
Or unnecessary self-elected rock stars who facilitate elite discourses.
Mm-hmm. Where are some of the least divided countries that you've either lived or stayed or visited? Where they just feel like they're all on the same
page?
Oh,
yeah, I can tell you that I've selected them very well, really. The best of the bunch. I mean, Costa Rica. Costa Rica's a great example. I was there on Saturday.
Yeah.
You know, they don't... They have quite a good infrastructure because they don't bother spending anything on a military or a navy. They don't have any navy or air force, essentially. Yeah, no military in Costa Rica. So there's more money to be spent on, human well-being.
Yeah.
Yes, and I would say, you know, Iceland's pretty good in this way. That was a good pick of the bunch, but I don't, weather, yes, well, that's another thing. I don't do winters anyway, if I can avoid it, you know. I mean, I'm sent to work in Russia for when it's 35 below. That's a different thing. I can brace myself for that. But I try to avoid going to cold places because I know how unstable India and Pakistan really is. Because, again, having a grandfather who fought in the 62 war, when India lost a lot of land to China, India can never win a land war with China. Right? So it would be tempted to use nuclear weapons. Now, similarly, Pakistan can never win land war with India. And they've already said last week, the Prime Minister of Pakistan said, if we start losing a land war, we'll use nuclear weapons. And as this, of course, I'm sorry to say, but an Islamic mindset, which basically says people who worship the many gods or pantheists are unbelievers, and therefore ... You see? You know, the height of religious extremism is a possibility there. You know. So I fear for these flashpoints because, you see, we're talking about my hatred of winter. Well, just imagine if there's a limited, quote-unquote, nuclear war between India and Pakistan. Well, all of us are in a nuclear winter. Right, all of us, the whole planet. Okay, so that means that when we're talking about, you know, 10 to 15 years of crop failure and mass starvation, you know, most people are unaware that 4 years before the French Revolution, 52 volcanoes went up in Iceland and it caused massive crop failure across Europe because there was no sunlight. which led, actually, was one of the underlying reasons that led to the revolution. You know, if you have to look at Jefferson's writings of this time, and when he went through France during this time, and then most people are unaware of this, you see. It can happen just like this, whether it's a super volcano or a nuclear war. And you see, we're not prepared for any of this. And don't ask me anymore, because I don't really have, I only have terror for you. Because we're going through a massive change. You and I, we're the last of our species, of sapiens. You see, we're morphing into Homo universalis, or there's different terms, but which is basically a transhuman option. Of course, you know, consider that all the bioorganisms that make up all life, our food, basically, our food comes from 1/300th of the planet, our total food. Think about that. And the bioorganisms are being depleted rapidly. There's no program to reverse this process, you know. There's different options available there. We can restructure the human digestive system, you know, and biotechnology. There you go. I mean, that's the thing. Is let's be honest about it. I mean, governments have been testing on human populations since the 30s. Fact, you know. And generally speaking, how we get ahead with technology is through wars. The only problem is, and this is it, you see. I mean, we hear of people talking very flippantly about World War, the next World War, you know. Bear in mind that the good old days of Nagasaki and Hiroshima are long gone. Like, one explosion of a thermonuclear bomb. Okay, just hypothetically imagine that it drops on London here. Well, that's a 600 square mile radius. That means from here to beyond John O'Groats, one bomb take out the whole country. And think about multiple explosions going off in countries. Can you imagine?
There's not going to be a lot left, is there?
That's right. And that's why I think that art can do things that diplomacy and politics cannot. And I really believe, you see, we're from a generation of musicians that believe you could change the world and people. And we still do, you see. We're different in this way to this, the next generations, I think. I want to play a role in that with art. And this work, this is it. I mean, when you hear the Gloria at the end, if, you know, it's an ambitious thing to try and score what world peace and planetary consciousness sounds like, but I dare to do it, you know. The other thing is with Killing Joke's music, you can never listen to it while you're eating. It gives you indigestion, you see. But with this record, I had in mind on a more secular level that it would make a great feast of the gods. So you could, you know, put the starter on and have the main course. And by the time, you know, we get to dessert and cigars and port and what have you, I mean, you know, we're still playing. So one of the things I want to do is have listening parties where we can have feasts.
Wine and dine.
Exactly. And listen to Killing Joke without getting indigestion, you see. Yeah. Which you can do with this record. Which is, you know, I like it. I love this record on so many levels. I truly have not stopped listening to it since I finished recording it.
Well, I think what it really succeeds in doing is, because Killing Joke's music has always been obviously very beautiful and layered and poetic, but when sometimes there's a lot of amplification and distortion, if the listener isn't invested in going on a certain sonic journey, they might just not see some of those things or hear some of those things. Whereas this record, I think, really brings all of that quality about Killing Joke's music to the surface, the nuance, the beauty, the poetry, these kind of more subtle
emotions. That's right, which is,
emotions,
people,
which the music's leathered
they miss, and they can listen to this and then come back to Killing Joke. I mean, it's an amazing thing for me to take out and what am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is, again, going back to the idea of self-education, that I became a maestro through hard study on my own, with other masters overseeing me, but basically I did it on my own, and then I applied the same principle to different things. I mean, I've acted once, but it was hellishly successful. You know, it's one of Czech Republic's favourite films of all time.
Yeah, yeah. So it's got The Year of the Devil.
Yeah, that's right. So, and I don't really want to act again unless the right thing came up.
Have things been offered and presented to you over the years that you
have
turned
down? Yeah, they have. Yeah. I mean, you know, when I was, like, drinking, I was a fucking animal, but a lot of people saw me, and, well, I can give you two instances. I'm trying to think of the film that I was that they saw me in a pub, the fucking giving someone shit or something, and then I was contacted by a casting company. I'm trying to think of the name of the film now. They wanted me to be an evil gangster in it. I'm trying to think of the name of the film now. It'll come to me in a minute. I didn't do it because we were on tour. There's a couple of things that have come up like this. And it was only the Year of the Devil thing happened because I was being secretly filmed before I knew I was even in the movie, which is kind of weird because, you know, the director had this idea of something called Natariska, which means no actors.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know about this, of course. So he went in disguise for the first 3 weeks. I just thought he was a kind of extra. You know,
just proper cinema verite.
Yeah. I just thought he was a hippie friend of the bands and of the folk group that I worked with. And it happened like this, by accident, really.
How many years have you been off the
13 pop? Years. I haven't had a drink for 13 years. I didn't do the fucking AA thing. It's so boring. I love pubs, right? And I like my friends to drink if they want to drink. You know, but I don't drink. That's it. You know,
was it hard to kick it?
No, not at all.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, the system that I've got, and I've got a lot of people off booze if they want to do it, but it's a scary one because you can't fail because it means death, because you take an oath, you see. Anyway, if you want to give up anything, a bad habit, always count like 7-8 days after a full moon and then make a decision then. It's easy to do. If you use the moon, which we do in Killing Joke, we use the moon. We have done all our whole career. We do all the creative stuff before full moon, and we throw out all the shit after a full moon.
What was the concert you performed? It's in the documentary that you made a few years ago, and you're all recalling, and all four of you had the same.
Oh yes, yeah, that's right.
Where
no,
everything
that
starts
was a weird
slowing
thing.
Down. And
no, that happened. You
what
know,
was
that? That was the Reading Hexagon.
Yeah.
You see this building, because I'm into the whole fucking ley line whole. This building is on a grid. That's really got me interested in measuring the Earth's magnetic field. That's where it's happened. Because, you see, when you increase a magnetic field, everything slows down. And when you decrease it or decrease a magnetic field, everything speeds up. Which is why everything seems like it's faster and faster at the moment, you see. Because we've got a depleting magnetic field. And so this started, you know, I started looking at the work of Dr. John Keeley
and other people and studying standing waves after this. After this experience, where everybody went through it.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody.
Yeah.
Everything slowed down, and it was because there must have been a pulse in the magnetic field. It was like being underwater.
Is that how you would describe it?
Yeah, everything was like being in a fish tank, going really, really slow underwater. It was like this. It was the weirdest thing. Everyone went silent, like real silent. It was the strangest experience. And then I wanted to basically learn how to recreate this at will. After this,
mm-hmm.
and that's where my studies began, which is a very personalized thing that I don't share with so many people.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And the experiments that you did as we approach the end, I just wanted to get your insight into the work that you were doing out in Iceland and how that's fed into the longevity of your career and, you know.
Sure, absolutely it has. I mean, you know, the whole thing with Iceland that was, again, studying the Earth's magnetic field, I'm always interested in volcanic regions. This is like Iceland, New Zealand. It was easy to see where to go, basically, to study this energy. You know, we started noticing the whole UFO phenomena manifested over these hot spots, these window areas on the Earth's magnetic field. And this is connected to my study in magic, because one of the things I never really talked with people about was that I worked with an initiate called Nima from the Order of Mars at the time. She was from Cincinnati, but I was very influenced by her work, and I met her later. And the difference about this fraternity is they would situate their rituals on the Earth's magnetic field, which I thought was very, very interesting. And this kind of inspired me to start a different school of thinking, basically, a new school of thinking in this area.
And that's absolutely then fed into your creative life. And
sure it has, yeah.
Voice and...
Yes.
What's your proudest achievement outside of music, Jazz?
Well, everything's connected to music, but I think seeing so many people's lives... transformed by our work, I think that's been incredible.
I guess that's like the ultimate reward for anything, isn't it? Is it something that you do has a positive impact on someone else?
Yeah. And the thing is, it's an ongoing thing. It's a lifestyle thing, and every time I so look forward to the tours of Killing Joke, you know, because we get to see everybody, you know, like the, okay, just forget the, yeah, the music's been a soundtrack to everyone's lives, but forgetting the music is the brother and sisterhood that we've created. Again, the difference is that we never saw our work as just a pleasure principle. It was, we always thought there was something revolutionary about it, that it could change lives. And one of the things that we started noticing quite early on is what we call the mirror effect, which is people see us and they're inspired to go and do their own thing, whatever medium it is. Of course, there's multiple musical options there, but there's also people have been inspired by Killing Joke in other areas as well, which has been fascinating. And it's good because what it does, Killing Joke, is it inspires people to go and find their God gift, because we believe that everybody is born gifted and life is just the location of your gift. And look, you know, we don't believe in working, Killing Joke. It's a stupid idea. You should only do what you love doing so you never have to work again. I mean, obviously.
Amen.
Obviously, you know. Why do you, so many people do things they don't like doing? I mean, it seems an obvious thing, but most people do it. They do things they don't want to do. And you should never surrender. That's the worst step you can make, actually. Because you get in life what you put up with. No, that's out of the question. It's silly. No, we believe that everybody's born gifted, and that everybody's born with this, or you can call it true will, if you like. And that when you do what you're meant to do, what you love doing, then you are securing your personal sovereignty. You're kind of spiritually one with the universe. I believe this, absolutely. And I believe in this because it's given me everything. You see, everything. I mean, it's a long journey from squats to self-education and becoming a maestro. It's a long journey on the back of Killing Joke. On the back of Killing Joke, because it was what money I made from Killing Joke went back into studying classical music, basically, which was intensive study from the time I went to Iceland. From there, non-stop. It wasn't really till a good 10 years later that things started happening.
And the journey's still very much going.
Oh, it's the most exciting bit now. You know, it's a very exciting time to be in Killing Joke now, because everything that we've said is happening. They said that we're paranoid, we're this and that, and everything. But now have a look.
Well, in the documentary, there's a journalist or a commentator is someone who's saying the 80s was kind of almost a foreshadowing of so much stuff, like the Falcons and things that happened.
That's right.
And you've always, I think, been that band. And it's such an interesting group because so few bands get better with age in the rock kind of realm. You know, most will make their definitive statements very early on and then will almost kind of focus. There's a handful, if that, well, that have continued to get better.
I believe you should never be too comfortable. You should always be a little bit lean and mean. And, you know, and the spirit around Killing Joke, the Mercurius, I call it. That's why we use the triple-headed snake. This is the energy of the alchemists, because it misled the alchemists. It doesn't like money, this energy that we invoke. It doesn't like money at all. It will mislead you. And if you get into money, it will kill you. So... superstition isn't the word for it, actually. I won't go in there. We just take what we need to get to the next step. But that's never, it's never been much. It's always been a struggle, and that's been the beauty of it, actually. Our first serious manager, Sam Alder, who basically saw Killing Joke as a kind of Masonic experiment, really. And he really helped us a lot. He said to me, the two really good things of he said, never let Killing Joke record in a paradise island kind of thing. He said, Killing Joke should always be in an urban environment. And I kind of believe this too, and I've really enjoyed going through the darkest times with my colleagues, and especially Geordie, who's been ever present in that journey for me. You know, we have an interesting relationship. You know, he's very dear to me, Geordie, but you know, we're very, very close. It's funny when we're in Prague, because he's on one side of the city and I'm on the other. There's a river between us, you know, and then we meet up at the airport, or sometimes in a park. Sometimes we meet in a park once in a while. But, you know, I mean, there's Killing Joke so active that, well, you know, I hang out with youth a lot outside of playing, you know.
The final thing I wanted to ask you, Jazz, is you mentioned these kind of dark times in your life a few times. How do you pull yourself out of those? What are your tools to get through the shit?
Okay. Firstly, I believe in the combined skills of the scholar and the warrior, which is to say your intellectual capacity is heightened by doing intensive physical exercise, you know, and it's good to do something martial, or be it boxing or whatever, or something, just for a mindset, you know. So these things are important. I mean, I'd say to anyone, you know, if you're in a negative place, put on some Killing Joke music and get on the treadmill and do an hour like fast walk at 7.8, you know, or you can run if you like, but that'll do, and go uphill. Just do this for an hour every day. You'll get into a good space. That's just for the beginning. But this, you know, like the endorphin rush with using your body. This is so important. I learned that this had a huge positive effect on me, because I suffered terrible depression. And then once I started, I stopped drinking, and then...
Did that help your state of mind as well?
Well, getting at the same time, I had one friend of mine who's like a serious fighter, like kickboxer, but like not very, very high level. And he's like a pop star as well. And he basically put me in the care of one guy who used to train Russian special forces. And he basically kicked my ass solidly for 2 years until I transformed. When he met me, he said, "You're close to death." Yeah. So this has been my transformation. Like this, come on, you know, I mean, doing Killing Joke live, it's a physical thing. Paul and myself, we have to stay fit. You know, Paul looks after himself. He was always the best fighter amongst us. Now, I don't know.
You've had your solid training. Well, Jazz, I mean, you look incredible. And life's obviously treating you well.
Well, you know what happened? The other thing that happened, I have to mention this, is that I went fishing on the rocks. And I got so into the fishing, I didn't notice that the tide had come in. And I couldn't get round the rocks because it did really come in. It was seriously rough. And I started getting real frightened because I'm on a cliff face. So I had to throw the rod away, and I had to go up this cliff, basically, and use my upper body strength to try and get me up, which wasn't particularly good then. And of course, like, my foot's all metal because of the accident I had in late 90s. And so I only just made it. So I thought, after that, it might be a good idea to do some pull-ups and all that. You know, because well now I can like fucking do 10 and I'm cool. But that really put the fucking wind up me. I thought I was going to fucking die, mate. Because I went up so high and there was no going back down.
You've got to keep climbing.
I was just... The only thing that got me through it is there's a psycho part of me. There's part of me that's completely insane.
Yeah. And that almost, I'm not going to be beat kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm a fucking psycho. Right. I mean, really, I'm a bulldozer. You can go ask people in my class at my school, and they say, he said he was going to do that. Right. Yeah, once I've got, I'm going to say, I'm going to fucking do it. Get out of my fucking way. Because right. I'll go for it. Hey, right. 10 years, I'll wait. Nothing, it's nothing to me. I'll hang in for a decade here, but I'll get there. Hey. You see, that was it. The other year I was in the high street in New Zealand, and this busker said, Jazz, listen to this song. And he played it, and he was just, it was just so overwhelming. It was just amazing, beautiful voice. And of course, I was suddenly struck with, how come he's there and I'm here?
You'd never met this guy before. He's just.
I met him once or twice because at the studio in Auckland. Because I listened to buskers and I had a number one out of taking a busker from Auckland High Street, and producing a Māori artist who I saw performing on Auckland High Street, and it went straight to number one. You know, that's way back in the 90s. So I always listened to the buskers and I used to. I had a little English pub in my studio. The studio's gone now because it's an old car factory. But I built a little English pub upstairs, you know. And everybody loved this place. Everybody would hang out in this place. And so I'd invite buskers back to the bar in the studio. And then, you know, we'd listen to some of their tapes and get fucked up and stuff, you know. And it was wonderful. And I got through the studio, I got to meet all the great players in New Zealand. And that was amazing. And of course, that all came out of Geordie and myself's obsession about islands at the ends of the earth, you know, basically. And then when the national anthem thing happened, you know, where I really did make a change with the music and the feeling of New Zealand's autonomy with the national anthem, that was an amazing experience. And it told me that there was destiny at work, and you know, and there is, you know, I feel it, I've felt it since childhood, and now here we are, Killing Joke now is, look where it is now, suddenly it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And you'll probably be getting even more brand new fans off the back of this upcoming tour that you're going to be doing with Tool, right? And how amazing is that, X amount of years into the game?
To tell you the truth, I don't really think too much about this. But I am looking forward to hanging out with the guys in the tour bus and having a fucking laugh and lots of bad behaviour.
Yeah. You only live once, right?
Yeah. No. No, you don't. Yeah. You live multiple lives over and over again. And when you meet somebody and you've never met them before, but you know everything about them, that feeling of,
yeah,
deja vu personified. Yeah. That's anamnosis, which means loss of forgetfulness. And I had this with every member of Killing Joke.
So you feel like you guys have been in each other's company?
Oh, sure. No question about that.
Stories and
no question about that. But I remember parts of past incarnations. You know, France, for example. And what is interesting is my first wife remembered me in France. And then people that I met in different fraternities in France said they remembered me then. And then I was decorated in France and I felt like I'd come home. It's funny because it's been such a big part of my life, that country. And then when I, what I really believe in,
transmigration of the soul.
But also like spiritual revolution, which is what we need, which is, again, it comes back down to magna invocatio, you know, from the point of light in the heart of God, let the light descend into the hearts of men. When I hear these words, you know, light and what it means to me, I wanted to score the angelic. Light is something angelic, and it is. It is, absolutely. You see, because the sum total of your incarnations is your supreme genius, and each one of us has got this. It's just, you see, Plato said, all knowledge is remembering. And I believe, you see, that each one of us has the genetic memory of mankind, even. When you think of cities like Mohenjo-Daro, when Sir Mortimer Wheeler excavated this city, and they found all the people in a human chain that had been burnt from the sky, incinerated, or in a huge human chain. I was so moved, I could almost remember, and so can you, when we were all holding hands, because I'm the other you and you're the other me, with the interconnectedness of humans, past, present, and future. We're only just learning this, you see, now. It's an amazing time. No. Reincarnation is very, very real. And we're connected by love. When I'm with somebody who's passing into the next world, I say to them, seek out love, light, and intelligence, and you find your way back home. This is central to it. It goes over and over again. Everybody is on a spiral course to perfection. I believe this. It's deep in me. And, you know, it's doing this record, this is one of the greatest achievements of my life, this record. Because it shouldn't have happened. But it was mysterious forces, and it all came together, and it just sounds absolutely amazing. Amazing. I still can't believe that we managed it.
It's divine.
Yes.
It's an amazing achievement.
Yes, yes. And
and you're a fascinating man, Jazz.
Well, everybody is. Everybody is. Everybody is the guru. Everybody. And that's it. And that's the whole thing about Killing Joke and the mirror effect. Everybody is. You see, you're looking at us, but we're looking at you.
Do you like what you say?
Yeah, I do. I love people. Yeah, I love human beings.
That comes across.
You know, like, who was it who said it? It was Lawrence Durrell, who was the brother of Gerald Durrell, the naturalist. He said, when the mob becomes the artist, we shall enter the golden age. And you see, when you look at how the arts in state schools, almost globally, has been reduced, decimated, the role of the arts.
Yeah.
You have to ask yourself, well, why is this? And I can answer that. The reason is that the arts are a potential source of dissent. That's the reason why, you know? And that's why the arts plays such an important role now,
you know. More than ever, yeah.
More than ever, you know.
I
love going to Russia and you know, I would go to Iran or anywhere on the planet to make music if I'm called, and I hope this is going to happen, you know. You know, I want to return to the Middle East next year and spend considerable time there, you know, with music and being there. So, yeah, I want to get into the heart of it all.
Please come on the show and let's do one of these again sometime.
Sure.
I'd very much
what
like
we'll
that.
What we'll do is you'll have to come on location with me somewhere.
I would adore that.
Yeah, you know, one of the trips I want to do, and if there's people who want to come and join me, because I live in South America now, is we're going to take a boat, and we're going to go up one of the tributaries of the Amazon, right the way up to a temple. And I want to do this, a big journey like this with a group of nutcases. So
I'm in.
That's what I think that people
Fitzcarraldo
these days,
style.
They need life-changing experiences. We have to, the ritualistic aspect is ever more important. You know, ritual is what separates man from the animal kingdom. It's certainly part of our world in Killing Joke, the ritual side of it. And anyway, when you get the full recording of this, you have to do a three-course meal somewhere and put it on. Once everything's done, you've got your guests there, put it on with some good speakers there and listen to it all the way through, you know. And have a look at the words of power that I've chosen when you see the words. Now, of course, I put everything in. There's five movements have got full chorus, and four of them are in Latin, but one is in Sumerian. And this is on invocation, and this piece it's an old prayer from Sumeria. It hadn't been recited for, 12,000 years or so. And so we got the professor of etymology at St. Petersburg University, and we got him to basically coach the choir on the pronunciation of the Sumerian. And suddenly, I heard it. I heard Sumerian with the track Invocation, which in itself is has a very interesting history, this track. It transports you to another world. It's a really heavy piece of music, really heavy. And you see, and the musical history of the song Invocation is interesting. And if anybody wants to check the musical history out one day, they can, because it goes to the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden when I did my first opera. And I did a third movement, which was about betrayal. The betrayal of Mary Magdalene, actually. And it went bam, 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 bam. It went, this is. And when we were in our darkest moments doing the Hosannas from the basements of hell, everybody had gone mad, Raven had gone, and we were fucking in a terrible state. And I thought I'd take that riff. And then I find it had a magical effect, that riff, actually. When you're being overcome by an enemy, it has a very, very powerful effect, this piece of music. When I did Invocation on Hosannas, I realized this. And so when I approached the score of Magnet Invocatio, what kind of turns me was pure anger like I never knew I had it in me. Because somebody rung up one of my daughters for a joke and said, your grandmother's just died. And so she rang my brother and rang me screaming. And I rang my brother. He said, no, Mum's here, she's alive. And then we traced a phone call.
What a fucked up thing to do.
Yeah. And I was so angry that I found this prayer, Sumerian war prayer, that I then scored over that music, and that's the outcome. This is an interesting thing because it makes you discover who the real enemy is, which is yourself.
Well, Joaquin Phoenix, who's about to play the Joker in this new movie,
So the other thing I was about to say to you, course, that period of Hosannas, when we did, what people don't know is Petra Zelenka, who's the director of Year of the Devil, he did that video when I was like drunk and overweight and fucking nasty. Right? You know, he directed that Hosannas from the Basements of Hell video. People don't know that. And that video, and stills from that video, was used by Heath Ledger, which he studied me for that part in The Joker. Wow. Over and over again, he had pictures and stills of me everywhere. When I was overweight and fucking drunk for smashing things up and fucking going, man, he used that from Hosannas and other stuff he'd seen, heard about me as the model. That is true.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, but this is you see, why I wear a mask on stage is because I know I have some experience with occult forces. It'll send you crazy, these forces of this energy. If you and I use the mask as protection. Even when I don't use it, I use it even just a little bit sometimes. Because I know that it sends you mad. This force, this energy, this energy of the Harlequin madman or fool. It's the 11th path on the Tree of Life, this energy. I know exactly what it is. And I know exactly what it does. I've had a 40-year experience with it. And I could have saved Heath Ledger. I could have saved him if I'd known him. Because you have to do certain things when you work with these energies. Energies are very real. My life has been about experimenting with manifesting dreams. And people have said that I'm crazy, and I am. And I absolutely am, because I don't differentiate between fantasy or reality. I'm completely crazy. Napoleon said, beware of the man who dreams with his eyes open. I'm one of those. Because it's all possible, you see. It's all possible. If you can dream it, you can do it. That's the thing. And then we have the possibility of those dreams and what we can do to heal the planet. Yes, I haven't lost sight of this, you know. But what is a fan club? What is an art center? Well, an art center to me has to be a farm these days, because when credit cards don't work, you can refer back to what Argentina went through in the first neoliberal experiments. You know, cities have got 3 days of food. Right? All we have is each other, and to learn unity, that we're stronger together, you see. And that's why I believe in the sort of collectivism, a green collectivism.
I could talk to you all day, Jazz. You're such a gentleman. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I love that,
mate.
I
so enjoyed sitting talking with you. I had a really great
time. I wish
time.
We had all night, but I'm aware that there's another...
But anyway, cook that meal.
I will.
Feast of the Gods.
I will. And great. I'm going to chat to Matt about coming on an adventure somewhere with you, because that would
Let's do it, you see?
A great honour.
Oh, absolutely.
And a great adventure,
yeah,
I'm sure.
You see, visualise it. There we are, you see. That's what it's about. That's why it's going to happen. And anyway, next year's my 60th. So you have to come for this. Come to paradise. Don't stick around here. Look, I'll give you one tip, right? January the 12th. The world's going to change on this day. There you go. It's been such a pleasure.
You too, mate. Thank you so
much. Thank you so much.
We'll do this again, I'm
sure.
Yeah,
we will.
Nice one, Jazz.
Thank you.
flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers,
Everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love, every step of the way. Because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.